From the studios of KPCW in Park City, this is Cool Science Radio. Science and technology that is accessible and entertaining. And if we can understand it, so can you. I'm Scott Greenberg.
And I'm Lynn Ware Peak. This morning we dive beneath the waves with James Bellingham, a pioneer in marine robotics, exploring uncharted oceans with autonomous underwater vehicles that are transforming our relationship with the sea.
Then we speak with John Green, author of Everything is Tuberculosis, the History and Persistence of Our Deadliest Infection. It's one of the stories of a disease that has infected between a quarter and a third of the world population. So, stay with us. This and more, you're listening to Cool Science Radio.
Welcome to Cool Science Radio. Today on Cool Science Radio, we're setting our sights on the ocean, an environment that covers more than 70% of our planet, yet remains largely unexplored.
Our guest is James Bellingham, Executive Director of the Johns Hopkins Institute for Assured Autonomy and author of the new book, How Are Marine Robots Shaping Our Future? James has been at the forefront of developing autonomous underwater vehicles, pioneering technologies that are transforming how we study the oceans, monitor climate change, and even secure global food supplies.
We'll explore how marine robots work, what they're revealing about our planet, and why the future of ocean exploration may depend on them. James Bellingham, welcome to Cool Science Radio.
A great pleasure to be with you. Thank you for having me.
Well, we're excited to talk to you because we talk on this show quite often about, say, the surface of Mars and the exploration therein, or the surface of the moon. We don't hear a lot about the deep oceans. Why is that?
I don't know. You know, this is one of the conversations my colleagues and I had, particularly, I can remember a few years ago, where there was a big meeting. Someone pointed out that, well, when you talk about adventure these days, you tend to talk about space. And don't get me wrong, I love space. I mean, I'm a big fan of all of the great things that NASA is doing. But holy smokes, you know, the ocean is just, it's full of life, right? I mean, you go to the moon and the moon's amazing, but it's dead, right? If you want to see strange creatures, go to the deep ocean. And not only that, but I have to say that my colleagues are sort of having literally adventures at sea every day. You know, I'm tracking a group of colleagues now who are sending sort of web updates from the Arctic where they're up there on a Korean ship. So this just amazing things going on all the time in the ocean environment. And that was part of why I wanted to write this book. I wanted to make it accessible and, you know, I wanted people to get excited about it.
So you have a PhD in physics from MIT, and I'm wondering at what point you launched into or why you went to the deep oceans instead of space.
I think, like, you know, I'm old enough that I remember that Apollo landing. Like, you know, many young Americans of that age, you know, I wanted to be an astronaut. I think that for me, what I kind of realized as I was getting my PhD, and I always viewed my PhD as sort of a foundation for something else. I have to admit, I honestly never visualized myself as being a physicist in a laboratory for the rest of my life. And so as I was looking around for what was I going to do next, I realized that the ocean was a lot more accessible. I was sitting in Boston at the time, and no one was doing it. I won't say no one was doing it, but there was very little going on in the way of marine robotics at that point. The field really didn't exist yet. And so you kind of look for where the opportunities are, and it just felt like this was an incredible place to make a difference.
Dr. Bellingham, when we think of autonomous, or when I think of autonomous, I think of my Roomba robot running around the floors of my house.
Right.
How does this translate over to autonomous robots in the ocean?
Well, so it's interesting. This is another reason why the ocean is kind of an exciting place to work. It's just hard, right? So what do you have? You have a bunch of things in your house that support that Roomba. You have electrical power. It can go plug in and repower itself. You have probably Wi-Fi. And you can probably connect to your Roomba and interact with it via Wi-Fi or maybe even Bluetooth. And you don't have that in the ocean either, because it turns out radio waves don't penetrate the ocean. So a lot of the things that you think of as being kind of just there, so the GPS that you use on your cell phone, you know, the ability to make a call, that all goes away when you get into the ocean environment. And so when you put a robot down there inside the ocean, it can't be like a drone that you're remote controlling, because we can't do that. We can't establish the radio link. You have to give it the ability to take care of itself. It has to be able to figure out where it is. It has to be able to figure out whether or not it's in danger, and it has to be able to take the appropriate responses to get the measurements that you want and to not allow harm to come to the vehicle. And those are all really interesting robotics challenges for us to work on, which are a little different, right, than the challenges that you're working on in your household environment.
Yes, but I love my Roomba. Tell me a little bit more. How has AI come onto the scene in helping the technology of the robotics, of autonomous robotics? I'm really curious about this, because you're right. This robot is down there. It's lonely. It's probably a lot of pressure, pun intended. What breakthroughs have been made in technology that allow this to actually be autonomous?
Well, so one of the things is, the early things that we did with the vehicle were pretty simple, right? So, you know, we called it mowing the lawn. So you put it down there in the ocean environment, and it kind of motors along a line, it moves over a little bit, and it goes down, and it makes a map, right? Or it measures the ocean properties in that environment. And that's already super useful, because you can't do that any other way. Now, 25, 30 years after we started all of this, we're working on much tougher problems. So I am very interested in, for example, the Arctic Ocean. And the Arctic Ocean becomes pretty much inaccessible to science for a good part of the year, because it freezes over in winter. And when it freezes over in winter, most of our icebreakers, come out of the Arctic Ocean. So we don't really have a good understanding. I mean, it's like the whole place becomes kind of invisible for us during that very interesting time of the year. So what we'd really like to be able to do is have our robots operate there in the ocean environment under ice, making all of these measurements during this period of year when we really can't be there any other way. And so those are the types of things right now that begin to drive different aspects of robots. So it kind of sounds boring, but one of the things I really care about is reliability. When you go to sea with one of these systems and they're pretty expensive and you put it in the ocean, there is a high level of stress on the part of the operator. Yeah, because you built it, right? You spent all the sponsor's money on it. And if it doesn't come back, this could be a career ending disaster. So you really want it to work. And now we want it to work not just for that one deployment off of a ship, but we want to put it in the Arctic Ocean. And not just one, we want to put networks of them in the Arctic Ocean, and we want them to operate for months at a time before, you know, in between people being able to sort of touch them and service them. So there's a lot going on, but I really am finding certain problems in the reliability space much more tractable with new AI today. So the ability to diagnose problems, the ability to kind of replan a mission if something went wrong, those are all things that are becoming much more tractable today than they were, 2 years ago. So it's a very exciting time.
If you're just joining us on Cool Science Radio, we're having a conversation with James Bellingham. He's the executive director of the Johns Hopkins Institute for Assured Autonomy, and he's the author of the new book, How Are Marine Robots Shaping Our Future? There's so many questions here. How deep are the robots going? And you talk about all of the inability to communicate with them. So how do you communicate?
Yes, the ocean on average is about an average of 3 miles deep, right? About 2.5 miles deep. And so the bulk of our planet is down around, 4,000, 5,000 meters, in that range. if you were an alien and you were coming to Earth and you were approaching from the Pacific Ocean side, pretty much all you would see is ocean. We would just look like a big ocean planet. You know, there'd be little fringes of, you know, there'd be a little island here or there, but we're basically an ocean planet. And most of it is down there deep. So of course we build robots to go down that deep. You want to map that part of the ocean. But it also turns out that vehicles that operate fairly shallow are super useful as well, because the sun is interacting with the top of the ocean. So that's where a lot of the life is, right? And that's where all of that interaction with the atmosphere is going on. And so that's a region also where, you know, I built a class of systems that were 300 meter rated. So it's at this like 3 football fields down they can go, which might sound deep, but, you know, given that the deepest part of the ocean is 11 kilometers deep, it's actually not that deep. But that turns out that gets you to most of that light-driven ecosystem part of the planet. So we have a range of different systems that we build. And it's kind of like airplanes. You know, there's everything from Cessnas to 747s to fighter jets, right? So in the underwater world, we want lots of different types of robots for their particular tasks. And yeah, the talking is a big problem. I have a graduate student who I have dumped that problem on, and I'm sure she's going to do a great job. The challenge is that you don't have silver bullets. You know, you don't have one thing that just works all the time. If you're up at the surface of the ocean, you can connect by satellite. But once you go below the waves, that all goes away. If you're in the ocean, you can talk acoustically, only if there's acoustic path that connects you, and not always so far, right? If you're really close and the water clarity is good, you can actually use optical comms, which is one of our highest bandwidth methods of communications. And then there's the old tried and true, you know, kind of underwater equivalent of sneaker net, which is just take the data from point A in your robot and drive it to point B and dump it over there. So you basically have a range of different tools for moving information around in the ocean. And actually, this is another one of the things which we would really like to improve via autonomy, is we like our systems to do a better job of choosing which is the right method to use in a particular situation, and whether communications is even needed. Because frankly, underwater, it's pretty expensive, you know, from an energy perspective. And oftentimes, you have to take time out from doing something else to communicate. Hey, a long answer to a simple question.
Yeah, well, there are so many simple questions that I'm sure we both have, in addition to our listeners. What are the answers to the questions that you have had that have been most exciting, most revealing about our deep ocean?
I will tell you that early in my technology career, I had a company lend me their sonar system so that I could use it to train students in sonar operation. And we used to go out on weekends and map the area off of Cape Cod, where there are literally hundreds of shipwrecks. That, to me, was, I don't know, it really sort of connects you across to the maritime tradition. You know, you're seeing these shipwrecks in some cases. A Dixie Sword was a ship that was torpedoed in World War II and made its way back to shore. The Pendleton, which they actually made a movie about, there's just a series of historic wrecks out there. And the other thing about this is how variable that offshore environment is. So it's, that particular area is not really that deep. And so what happens when the winter storms come in, they move the sand. And so a wreck which is completely exposed might be completely covered by sand the following summer. And another wreck which had been hidden suddenly is now visible. So if the coastal environment, it can be a very dynamic environment as well. So that was one of the things that kind of began to really pull me into all of this. I will say that my friends who are microbial biologists have really done a great job of brainwashing me into believing that microbial biology is the future, and understanding that is the way to understand the human future on the planet. And so I have to say, I love learning and working with that group of scientists. And I do feel like, you know, we're beginning to develop some tools which are giving us glimpses into how marine ecosystems organize, who's on top, who's getting eaten, who's dying, why they're dying. All of those things are crazy questions which are really remarkably hard to answer unless you get a little robot down there watching all of the time. To me, that's very nerdy, but super exciting.
Well, they say it takes a village, and now it takes a village of sciences.
True.
So we just talked a little bit. You just touched on, okay, so there's shallow and there's deep, and the different ecosystems. What are the ways that marine robots are expanding our knowledge of ocean ecosystems from the coral reefs all the way down to the deep, deep blue?
Yeah, so I think that the some of the key things that they're being used for is, first of all, just how does the ocean circulate? So we tend to sort of think of the ocean as, you know, being the physical ocean, which is, you know, the water, the salt in it, the temperature of the water, and understanding that interaction and kind of what is the internal weather of the ocean really is a foundation for understanding so much of the rest of the ocean environment, how the ocean is as a habitat. And so there's a lot of use of some of the simpler but most reliable and longest endurance vehicles in the ocean are used for studying that ocean, those ocean circulation processes. As a matter of fact, you can go online, and if you Google Argo, the Argo array, you can see data coming back from all of these floats. There's thousands of them over the world's ocean, which sounds like a lot, right? It turns out that if you do the math, it's like two in the an area the size of the state of California, you know, thousands of them. It certainly is a lot if you have to make them all, but it's not a lot when you're trying to reconstruct what, you know, what's going on in the ocean. Then we have more sophisticated systems that look at the places where the currents are higher near the coastline, and those are beginning to help us understand how the boundary currents, which are the stronger currents often like the Gulf Stream, how those interact with the nearshore environment and how nutrients move back and forth, how they sort of shape fisheries. These are all kind of evolving questions that the scientists are grappling with, and these underwater robots in various shapes and forms are beginning to fill in the picture of.
So like a lot of people, I enjoy a good sushi every now and again. Highlight in your book that these autonomous robots may influence global food supply, the information we're getting from these autonomous robots. And can you explain how these technologies intersect with fisheries and aquaculture, which again, combine to make sushi?
Well, so first of all, you know, wild fisheries are stressed. So, you know, if you look at the amount of fish we extract from the ocean from the normal fishing process, so there's only so much you can do there before you collapse fisheries. And we're pretty close to that on many of them, although countries are getting better and better at managing that. And so as a consequence, we're beginning to do in the ocean over the last 100 years or so, it's really beginning to take off. What we did on land literally millennia ago, which is we're learning to farm the ocean. And in this case, you know, farm it for fish. And what you get is much higher productivity in the regions where you do this, but you also get environmental impacts as well. And so part of you know, learning this new way of cultivating parts of our environment for our food system, you know, revolve around figuring out how to do this sustainably and in a way that is beneficial, right? You know, not just for an immediate short-term use, but is, you know, will be sustainable over the long run. And so in order to do that, what you really want to be able to do is predict stuff. So for the wild fisheries, you would really like to be able to say, well, you know, for a particular class of fish, you know, for cod, you can fish this much this year because we're expecting, you know, the fish stocks to be at this level. And it turns out we're pretty terrible at that prediction. So it turns out our ability to predict fish stocks, you know, sounds like you go, okay, well, you got, you know, a certain number of fish, they're all going to spawn, you know, so next year should be, you know, kind of a, you know, should be directly related to that. It turns out that maybe they'll spawn, maybe they'll get eaten, maybe predators, you know, particularly will go after the young ones. Maybe ocean currents will change and where they can't reach where they normally spawn. It turns out that even if you fish out the older fish, sometimes the fish forget, you know, where they have to go to spawn. So it turns out that for some fish species, that those older fish are the ones that have the memory of where to go. So there's so many variables that factor into this that we're really kind of still in the discovery process of learning how these ecosystems work. And what do you need to do that? You need to be able to observe those systems. And so these robots are a way to, a tool for scientists to use to have the ability to make these measurements. And you know, ideally, you would like to be there all the time. I always say that, you know, if you're a hunter on land, you know where the fish go, or, you know, excuse me, where the deer go to water. You know, you know where they go to sleep at night, and, you know, you can track them. You know what they're doing. In the underwater environment, we tend to be sort of drive-by. We are paparazzi. You know, we get a snapshot of the ocean at a particular time, but we never really get a chance to follow them. So where do these lobsters go during winter when they wander off the shelf? And what are they doing there? And, you know, is there something that we can do that makes that a more productive time for them, right? Or is there a particular time in their life cycle when we're intervening, which maybe if we just didn't, we just sort of held off in that period, we would have larger lobster stocks? Those are all questions that really depend on your ability to observe that environment in a much more detailed way than we have been able to.
Yeah, that's so interesting. And, you know, it seems fairly recent that these fish farms were spreading lots of disease amongst itself. And then the overuse of the antibiotics was creating a product that wasn't overall really healthy for us to consume. And that's pretty recent. So in terms of how marine robots are helping us with that kind of question, what are the questions that we need to solve there, and how are they doing that?
Yeah, that's a great question. So I'm actually just back from Norway, where I'm on the science advisory panel for the Norwegian government's entity, which is responsible for monitoring the health of their fishery systems and their aquaculture systems, which for them are the second largest industry, by the way. So for them, this is a very big deal. They are kind of the best in the world at salmon farming. So they have a very high-tech salmon farming industry, but they have a really big problem. So you mentioned this issue, you know, unintended consequences. In their case, they have a sea lice problem. So it's a parasite that will infest the salmon and at one level make it a fish that nobody is going to want to eat, and at another level kill the fish. So for them, they're very concerned about this, and it's very related to how dense the salmon farming is. So figuring out what that right density of farm is, and is there anything that you can do, for example, prevent the spread of salmon from one farm to another, that all depends on having a great understanding of environment. You know, what are the currents there? And these fjords, which is where they put them, are pretty complicated environments. Many of them are very deep. They have a freshwater cap sometimes if you have freshwater coming off of land. So the circulation is kind of strange. So instrumenting all of that to understand that environment better has really been one of their central focuses. And you really want to couple that measurement system to a prediction system, partly because that's kind of the point. You want to be able to predict this. But the other thing is, if you try to predict something, that tells you a lot about whether your models are right and whether you have the right observations. So if your predictions are wrong, that tells you got to go back and fix it. And then maybe it gives you some clues as to what you're getting wrong and where you need more measurements or which part of the model is wrong. So those are all, it's kind of like we're building the bicycle while we're riding it, you know?
It's really illuminating for me, that question in and of itself, because yes, I love sushi, but I really eat salmon every single night. And I, you know, of course, I hesitate to, because for that reason, because there's so many practices that we haven't really figured out. But I can see now you're really making it clear how marine robots can help us collect data and learn about how to do things correctly. You know, James, before we let you go, I just have to ask you about this, about the pressure. I think it was 2 years ago that there was that horrible tragedy of the you know, the Titanic acceleration, Ocean Gate, and I think five people lost their lives from the implosion of the capsule that they were in because of the pressure. Can you talk about that kind of pressure? I mean, that was at what, like 3,000?
Yeah. So basically, you know, we design a lot of our systems for 6,000 meter depth rating. And there we're usually designing to an external pressure of about 10,000 pounds per square inch, right? So every square inch of that pressure vessel is having 10,000 pounds of pressure pushing in on it. So the deep ocean, this is one of the fundamental challenges of working in the deep ocean is the high pressures. And if you look at pictures of human submersibles that go down to that depth, they usually have a big sphere because spheres resist crushing better than other shapes. And usually those spheres are inches thick, right? They're really thick. In the case of Ocean Gate, what they wanted to do was they wanted to bring more people down to the seafloor. And so they didn't want to use a sphere. So they built something which had a cylinder with hemispheres at either end. And they needed that. And the problem is because a cylinder is not as good at resisting pressure as the sphere, it has to be thicker, which makes it heavier, which makes it harder to carry the batteries. It makes it harder to bring the people down. At some point, it's heavier than the water it displaces, and then it just doesn't work, right? Remember Archimedes' principle that, you know, your buoyancy force is equal to the weight of the water that you're displacing. So that was the fundamental challenge that they had. And so Stockton Rush's idea was, well, we'll use carbon fiber hulls because they're very strong and very light. Now, the thing about carbon fiber is, if you've seen it, it's actually like a string. So a carbon fiber is like a string. And, you know, and what's happening here, the pressures on your hull are compressive pressures, right? So, you know, if you push a string, does it have strength? No, it doesn't, right? It has strengths when you pull it. So the only strength that you get from these carbon fiber hulls is when you embed them in an epoxy matrix. And it turned out that that was a science project. Doing that really well is not something we have really fully figured out yet. And, you know, he began to realize this, but he was sort of in too deep. And every time his people spoke up and said, you know, maybe we shouldn't do it, he just fired them. And then he finally stored it outside, which was a really bad idea. He stored it outside up in Canada, which meant that you, like a road, it's like a, think of a road, right? You know, water gets in, it freezes, it breaks the road. Well, the same thing was happening with this carbon fiber pressure vessel. And so the first time he used it after that winter storage, it was when it imploded. I teach a class which is technical leadership in times of crisis, and I use this as one of the examples of how not to do it for my students.
Oh yeah, I bet you were just watching that and just shaking your head. And
it was tragic. It was truly tragic. Yeah.
Boy, this is just so interesting, James, and I'm so happy we had the opportunity to talk to you. I feel like I could keep talking to you for the rest of the hour, but we have to let you go. Our guest, James Bellingham, is the executive director of the Johns Hopkins Institute for Assured Autonomy. I just love that there is an Institute for Assured Autonomy. That's so wild.
We do our best.
Yeah, you absolutely do. He's also the author of the new book, How Are Machine Robots Shaping Our Future? What an interesting topic. And James, thank you so much for joining us on Cool Science Radio.
My pleasure.
Today, we explore the story of a disease that has infected between a quarter and a third of the world's population and has haunted humanity for centuries, tuberculosis. Our guest is John Green. He's the author of Everything is Tuberculosis, The History and Persistence of Our Deadliest Infection.
If John's name sounds familiar, it's because he is the award-winning author of books, including Looking for Alaska, The Fault in Our Stars, Turtles All the Way Down, and The Anthropocene Reviewed.
In his latest book, Green explores how this ancient scourge has shaped medicine, culture, and society, and why, despite modern medicine, TB, as it's known, continues to claim lives worldwide. John, welcome to Cool Science Radio.
Thank you so much. It's great to be with you.
You say that you are obsessed with tuberculosis. You became obsessed back in 2019, I believe, when you visited Sierra Leone and met a boy named Henry Ryder. Tell us about
it. Yeah, so I didn't go to Sierra Leone to learn about TB. I went to learn about the maternal health care system. But on our last day there, the doctors we were traveling with asked to visit a TB hospital because they had some cases they wanted to consult on. And sadly, one of those cases was Henry. So Henry was a young kid. He looked to be about 9 to me, but in fact, he was 17 at the time. His body had just been so stunted by malnutrition and then by tuberculosis that he looked much younger. But Henry took me all around the hospital. He took me to the kitchen. He took me to the lab. He took me to the men's wards where patients were living. And because he spoke relatively good English and he's just an unusually charismatic kid, we really formed a connection. And I came home, you know, concerned about Henry, but also concerned about what was wrong with my own information feed, that I had no idea that tuberculosis was the world's deadliest infectious disease, that it was killing over 1 million people a year, even though it's been curable since the 1950s. I was curious about what that says about us, about the systems that we've built to try to spread good health around the world. I was curious about what it said about me as well, that I had been so ignorant to this scourge, as you say. And so over the next 5 years, I kind of got obsessed with tuberculosis. I say that I fell in hate with it. And between that and following Henry's story as he tried to recover from multi-drug resistant tuberculosis, I ended up writing a book about it, which surprised me as much as it surprised my publisher.
Yeah, it's a little bit of a departure for you. You're known for these young adult fictions, but...
Yeah.
But you say it's not really a departure, that there are similarities, and how so?
Yeah, there are some similarities, right? I mean, I'm writing nonfiction instead of fiction. I'm writing for adults instead of writing for teenagers. But at the same time, the story centers on a teenager. Henry, you know, was between 17 and 20 when he was receiving treatment for tuberculosis. And, you know, Henry also loves poetry. I love to write about kids who like to read and like to write. And so in some ways, you know, Henry is a prototypical John Green character. It's just that he's a real person with a real complex, multitudinous life.
John, I have to say that I was taken by surprise, and I'm sure most people are, to find out that tuberculosis is so rampant and throughout the world. I mean, I had absolutely no idea. You mention in your book how tuberculosis, at least in the last century, has actually shaped humanity, and particularly even in the United States. We've had entire towns and cities pop up to center on the treatment of tuberculosis. Tell me about how that got unraveled in your research.
Yeah, I mean, from Pasadena, California to Asheville, North Carolina, where my great uncle Stokes Goodrich died in 1930 in a sanatorium, there are many American cities that were essentially founded as TB colonies. It's hard to overstate how significant the tuberculosis crisis was in American history just 120 years ago. I mean, at the peak of the TB crisis in the United States, which was around, I mean, in terms of the sanatorium age, it was around 1910, there were almost as many hospital beds devoted to tuberculosis patients as there were hospital beds for all other healthcare conditions combined. That's how huge of a problem tuberculosis was. And so there were commensurate resources to try to respond to that problem, you know, from Kansas to my home state of Indiana. Sanatoria were built to house tuberculosis patients, to offer them what was seen as the best treatment at the time, which was essentially rest and access to sunshine. And, you know, that worked insofar as rest and proper nutrition are better than malnutrition and not rest, but not very effective in the end. But because we were devoting so many resources to TB, we eventually discovered a cure for tuberculosis. In the 1940s and 1950s, we began to develop these really powerful antibiotics that over time can cure TB. Now, it's not like curing a sinus infection. It doesn't require like 7 to 10 days of antibiotics. It requires months of antibiotics taken in a particular combination every day. And so it's rigorous treatment, but it is possible. And in fact, you know, it should be universal.
For those of us who are unfamiliar with tuberculosis, as am I. Can you tell us how it's transmitted? Is it airborne? Is it human touch? I'm curious, how does this get around and why is it so infectious?
Yeah, it's an airborne disease, and it doesn't take many particles of bacteria to make you sick. It only takes about 10, and you can get it anywhere. You know, you can get it in a bus, you can get it at your workplace, you can get it at home, but it tends to strike people who have other healthcare issues, especially malnutrition. So about half of all people who develop tuberculosis will also be malnourished.
John, I said in the intro that it's, you know, about a quarter to a third of the world's population has been infected by TB.
Yeah.
There's a difference between the types of TB. There's a latent and an active, as I understand.
That's correct.
So it's kind of like HIV in that way, right? So it can be latent in you. And then the triggers things like malnutrition that brings it into an active disease.
Yeah, so we don't fully understand everything that makes TB go from latent to active. It's a weird bacteria in that it replicates very, very slowly. Like it replicates maybe once per day, whereas E. coli will replicate once every 20 minutes. And so it's just a very different kind of bacteria. And as a result, the body's strategy for dealing with it is different because it also has part of the reason it replicates so slowly is it has this thick, fatty cellular coating that makes it really hard for infection-fighting cells to penetrate. And so what usually happens is that white blood cells sort of surround the bacteria and give it a place where it can sort of lie dormant or semi-dormant. And that's called latent tuberculosis, right? You have tuberculosis in your body, but it's not a threat to you. And many, many people, I mean, about 90% of people who are infected with tuberculosis, which as you said, is billions of people right now, about 90% of them will never get sick. They will never develop active tuberculosis. They'll never have the ability to pass on tuberculosis to anyone else, et cetera. But in about 10% of cases, or maybe a little less, people do develop active tuberculosis. And sometimes we know why. Sometimes it's malnutrition. Sometimes it's diabetes is also a huge risk factor. HIV infection is a huge risk factor for tuberculosis because it damages the immune system. And so it makes it harder for the body to surround all the bacteria with those white blood cells. And so we know some of the risk factors, but then sometimes people get sick and we don't understand why. And usually people get sick within 2 years of their initial infection, but sometimes they are healthy for decades and then develop active tuberculosis. It continues to be a very mysterious disease, in part because when it stopped being an issue in the rich world, which was in the 1960s and 70s, we really stopped investing in tuberculosis. And so we just don't know as much as we could because we haven't been investing the kind of scientific resources that we ought to have been in the intervening decades.
Well, like you, like Scott, and probably like a lot of our listeners, I was also unfamiliar with tuberculosis. I guess if I were asked to, you know, say what I know about it, I would also say that it's something that is not present in this country. And that's not
right.
True at all. And when you talk about a trigger being diabetes, and in this country, diabetes, especially type 2, is rampant and on the rise, unfortunately, until we get, you know, our health under control in this country. So what's going on in this country and how can we expect to be treated versus how little Henry Ryder was treated in Sierra Leone?
Yeah, that's a great question. So if I got tuberculosis tomorrow, I would immediately get what's called a molecular test. So I would get a test that not only says whether or not I have tuberculosis, but talks reveals something to the doctors about what kind of antibiotics my tuberculosis in particular will respond to, whether I have certain kinds of drug resistance, et cetera. And so I would almost immediately be started on a regimen that was appropriate for my particular tuberculosis. And there is tuberculosis in the United States. We have about 10,000 cases of active TB in the U.S. every year. We have some number of deaths from tuberculosis. It's relatively small, but we do lose people to tuberculosis. Here in my home state of Indiana, we lost someone to tuberculosis just a few weeks ago who actually died before they were diagnosed, which is pretty common. Because it's not something, you know, there's the old saying that doctors look, when they hear hoof prints, they look, or hear hoof sounds, they look for horses, not for zebras. And tuberculosis in the U.S. is definitely a zebra. But we do have about 10,000 cases of active TB a year here. We lose some people to tuberculosis. So it's not impossible to get TB in the U.S. It's not even that uncommon. It's just that you immediately get appropriate treatment. And so in my case, let's say I did have drug resistance. Well, with the newest regimens, I'd probably be cured within 6 months of taking antibiotics. So it would be difficult. You know, my brother had cancer a few years ago. He had a very treatable kind of cancer called Hodgkin lymphoma. And it required about 6 months of intensive treatment for Hank to be cured. But at no point in that 6 months did anyone say, well, I'm not sure it makes sense just cost-wise to treat your cancer. And that, unfortunately, is what people like Henry often hear in places like Sierra Leone. So when Henry got tuberculosis, there were no molecular tests for him. And so he was started on the standard tuberculosis drugs that we've had since the 1950s and 60s. And those were not appropriate for him because he had drug resistance. And so he failed that regimen. He was then started on a second regimen, which he also failed. And that's when I met him. And that's when his doctors were really concerned, because while you or I would be able to access the third or fourth line of antibiotics, they were seen as too expensive for someone like Henry. And one of his doctors actually told me, that's the point at which you put the stethoscope down. But fortunately for Henry, his doctors did not put the stethoscope down and worked really, really hard with the Sierra Leonean Ministry of Health and an organization called Partners in Health to get Henry the kind of personalized, tailored treatment that you or I would expect and that everyone deserves. And that's why he's here with us today.
John, this sounds like a very personal story for you, which it feels like it's almost haunted you. And we talk about this TB, and particularly for Henry, we talk about how tuberculosis can be resistant to some antibiotics. Mm-hmm. And it feels like Henry, for lack of a better word, got a little lucky that somebody wasn't going to give up on him. But if you're in a part of the world, or even part of the United States, where you don't have access to that kind of healthcare, it seems to me that poverty or even location can really be detrimental to your treatment of tuberculosis.
Yeah, I mean, the ultimate cause of death by tuberculosis in the 21st century, we can't really say it's the bacteria anymore, right? We can't say that because we know how to cure the disease. You know, occasionally someone will develop a kind of drug resistance or be a kind of sick that we just don't have tools to deal with, but that's very occasional. The vast majority of people who die of tuberculosis, and that'll be over 1.3 million people this year, 4,000 people today. The vast majority of those people are not dying because we don't have the tools to deal with them. They're dying because we haven't implemented the tools globally. And, you know, to extend that out, really they're dying because of structural injustice. They're dying because of poverty. And I think you're absolutely right that is the ultimate cause of death in the case of the vast majority of tuberculosis deaths. And that's not just a tragedy, it's an outrage. And I think you're right that it is personal for me, because I care about Henry, because I care about other TB survivors, because I've been privileged to know a lot of people living with TB, because I've been privileged to know people who died of TB. But it's not just personal because of that. It's also personal because I participate in these systems. I'm a part of the global, distribution of resources. And in many ways, these systems have benefited me and given me access to megaphones that most people don't have access to. And so I really, in this book, wanted to try to use that megaphone as best I could.
I remember as a young man, when I would go to the doctor for a checkup, or, you know, before you went, tried out for college sports, or even, you know, going to high school, they would put a bubble under your skin.
Yeah.
A TB test, as I recall, and it would itch, but, you know, I don't think I ever had a positive reaction to this. And I'm curious if there have been any kind of new tools in either diagnosing tuberculosis or maybe fighting. Do we talked about antibiotics, but are there vaccines on the horizon? Are there better diagnostic tests on the horizon? What are we doing in the scientific community today about tuberculosis?
There's a lot on the horizon. I think some of that stuff has slowed down because of a slowdown in research funding more generally, but there is still a lot on the horizon. I think most significantly, there are several vaccine candidates on the horizon. There's one stage 3 vaccine trial happening now that could be transformative if the results are good. The only vaccine we have for tuberculosis is 105 years old, and it's not particularly effective. It only prevents severe illness and death in young children, so it's not effective for adolescents or adults. And it's a blessing that we have anything, but we shouldn't be in a situation with a bacterial illness where the only vaccine we have is 105 years old. In terms of diagnostics, we still use the bubble test quite a lot. We use it because it's incredibly cheap, but we mostly use it in places like the U.S. where we don't use that vaccine. Because we don't have a lot of childhood tuberculosis. We don't have a lot of tuberculosis circulating in the U.S., and so we don't use that vaccine. If you use that vaccine, the number of false positives from that skin test are so high that it can be a little difficult to use. But it is still used. It's very cheap. It's been around for a long time. We now have much better diagnostic tools. So we have chest x-rays, which are really useful, especially AI-enhanced chest x-rays that have been trained to look for spots of concern in the lungs. We have these molecular tests called GeneXpert or TrueNAT that are really effective, not just at establishing whether someone has tuberculosis, but also at establishing drug resistance. But all those tests have weaknesses. I mean, I think the biggest weakness is that we still don't have a good test for kids because kids struggle to produce enough sputum for the sputum tests. And so it's really, that's a really devastating thing, to have known what caused this illness since Robert Koch identified M. tuberculosis, 145 years ago, and still not have a test for kids is pretty damning, I think.
If you're just joining us on Cool Science Radio, we're having a conversation with writer John Green. He's talking about his new book, Everything is Tuberculosis. It's funny, about the time I heard about your book, John, I also had seen tuberculosis kind of popping up in the news. And you say that since COVID, there has been a rise in this country. And how is it related to COVID? Just because our healthcare, we weren't getting healthcare, it wasn't being identified, or what?
I think it mostly wasn't being identified. So this was true around the world. We saw a huge increase in tuberculosis cases and deaths during the peak of the emergence of the COVID pandemic. And that was because so many resources had to be appropriately redistributed toward COVID that tuberculosis often went undiagnosed or untreated. And that was true, less true in the United States than it was elsewhere, but it was still true in the United States. And so that's one of the reasons we're seeing tuberculosis rise in the United States. But I think we have to be honest that another reason is that we just don't fund our public health departments as well as we used to. And they are really the front line in the fight against TB.
What are the symptoms of TB?
So a cough is very common. I mean, there's two kinds of tuberculosis. There's what we call pulmonary tuberculosis, and there's extrapulmonary tuberculosis. Tuberculosis can invade almost any system in the body, but it's very uncommon. Most of the time, it's pulmonary tuberculosis, at least especially here in the U.S. A cough, often a cough that starts out as a dry cough. In Sierra Leone, actually, TB is called dry cough TB. That's the Creole phrase for the disease. But then it becomes a very productive cough. You sometimes see blood in your sputum. That's the kind of classic symptom of tuberculosis, around the world. When you see somebody coughing into a rag and they look and they see blood in the sputum, that's like the giveaway that this is consumption or tuberculosis. So that's a very common symptom. And then, unfortunately, a lot of wasting. It's a wasting disease. And so losing a lot of weight suddenly is an area of concern as well.
John, your book, Everything is Tuberculosis, is fantastic. And by the way, I went on and watched just a 4-minute clip of you on YouTube talking about this book. It's absolutely fantastic. I hope people can Google that and find that very quick little clip of you describing this book, because it is, no pun intended, really infectious. I hate using that, but after immersing yourself in this in this book, particularly because of Henry in Sierra Leone. What do you really want most for your readers to take away about this disease and its ongoing impact in our society?
My great friend, Amy Cross Rosenthal, who passed away a few years ago from cancer, liked to say, pay attention to what you pay attention to. And I think we tend to solve the problems we pay attention to, and we tend not to solve the problems we don't pay attention to. And so I want tuberculosis to be on the very long list of things we need to pay attention to, but I want it to be on that list. I want people to be conscious of it. You know, I want to take them on the journey that I've been on, from total ignorance of this disease to an awareness of it in an ongoing way. Because, you know, once you're alive to a crisis, once you're alive to an emergency, you stay alive to it, you stay aware of it. And so I'm hoping that I can just bring some attention to the crisis.
Well, it's been a pleasure and an honor to speak with you, John Green. The book, Everything is Tuberculosis, is out. It's a short book. It's an engaging book. And it kind of goes hand in hand with what you're trying to do right now, which is to bring awareness to these various things. And oh my gosh, I'm forgetting the name of your project on YouTube. Blanking.
Crash Course. I don't know. Crash Brothers. I have a lot of them.
Crash Course is kind of what I was thinking of.
Oh, sure.
So tell us just a bit about that before we let you go.
Yeah. So my brother and I, for the last 13 years, we've been sharing free educational videos on YouTube, teaching everything from biology to chemistry to literature to history. And, you know, it's been a huge part of our life. And one of the great gifts of our life has been being able to make these videos for young people to help them understand not just history or biology, but in general, the joy of learning, the opportunity to better contextualize yourself and yourself in the universe. And that's, you know, our dad was a documentary filmmaker. And so for us to be able to kind of continue the work that he did in his career is very meaningful for us.
Yeah. Well, it's wonderful work. And I must say you're very engaging on YouTube. And also, so your Audible book or your audio book is it you narrating it?
Yeah. I'm the narrator. I enjoyed doing that a lot. Like I feel like when the author is a character, and I am inevitably sort of a character in this story, I feel like it's best when the author does it. So I really enjoyed making the audiobook.
Oh, absolutely. Well, thank you so much for joining us on Cool Science Radio. It's great to have you.
Thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
Thanks for tuning in to Cool Science Radio. As always, you can find our archive shows at kpcw.org under the Shows tab and Cool Science Radio, or wherever you get your podcasts at kpcw Cool Science Radio. And if you liked today's episode, rate us, subscribe to the show, and share it with your friends.
If you have a suggestion for a guest or topic for a future episode, email us at coolscienceradio@kpcw.org. We'll be right back.